Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me today, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, who's usually here with us, is off this week. And what a week to take a vacation, because some of us wish we'd stayed in bed also. It's Wednesday, the day after the Indiana primary, the withdrawal of Ted Cruz from the race, and the virtual enshrinement of Donald Trump as the Republican presidential nominee in 2016, the day that we had all dreaded the passage of, the possibility of, the ascension of a sociopathic, ad hominem, illiterate, unprincipled, idealist, fake billionaire,
conspiracy theorist,
supporter of Clinton's and affirmative action and Planned Parenthood and everything that you can imagine, is now somehow become the standard bearer of Abraham Lincoln's party, while his alt-right and racist supporters revel in their triumph and their seizure of the reins of power. So it's a fun day for us all. And how are you feeling, Abe?
Yeah, it's splendid. It's in some sense, there's the sort of Band-Aid being ripped off, as opposed to the slow peel.
I guess. Although this has been yesterday on Twitter, I said that this is the culmination of 5 months of watching a car crash coming in slow motion, and you're staying there going, no, don't do it. And last night, the cars finally collided. And
while you're watching that slow motion car crash, everyone's coming up to you and saying, isn't this election fun? Isn't this fascinating?
Yeah, not a lot of people came up and said that to me. Most of the people I know are as distressed as I am, except for my friend Steve, who won a $1,000 bet from me, because he said in September, October that he thought Trump was going to be the nominee. And I said, you're crazy. And I bet him 50 to 1, 50 to 1 odds. Mm. So he'd pay me 20, I'd pay him 1,000. And I lost. Then I went back and I looked at our archive, and I discovered that in July of 2015, I had written a blog post called The Case for Despair, in which I said what's gone on with Trump is unprecedented, and it's the worst thing that's happened in American politics, and it may be world historical and epical, and we have nobody to blame but ourselves, and this is no joke. And yet, even I, having written this, made this bet 2 months later, because I couldn't believe that this could possibly happen in reality, even though I had myself told myself and the readers of Commentary at CommentaryMagazine.com that this might, in fact, happen.
Well, would Steve go double or nothing on a general election?
I probably not, and I'm not sure that right now I would have I would feel the great comfort necessary to bet. Although, remember, Trump's victory was foretold at that time by polls in which he was leading from July onward and never surrendered the lead. Ever. And of course, Trump, the polls now all show Trump losing, and the first poll after the election shows him losing by 13 points. And there is one poll that has him in the lead, 41-39. But that poll dictated to the respondents that every single person had to say what they would do if they had no choice but to vote in November 2016. Of course, the main issue that faces Trump and Hillary Clinton in this election is with their unbelievably high negatives. Candidates with very high negatives tend to depress turnout among their own party members, and negative campaigns depress turnout. That's one of the reasons that people resort to them, and incumbents often resort to them with great vigor, because one of the ways that they can ensure their reelection is to depress the turnout among people who are going to vote for their rival. So it's not that they win people over to their side. They just make them feel ugh about voting for the guy on their side, so they just stay home. Right now, it seems very plausible that Trump will have historically low numbers of Republicans in aggregate voting for him in November. Remember, Romney got 90% to 95% of Republicans. So did John McCain, not very popular among Republicans, one thought. I think Trump will be lucky to get 80. And if that happens, by the way, he can't win. So
there was a CNN poll that I saw today that said if he gets 100%, he can't win.
Right. That's right, because he needs independence, and he needs, and remember, independents have tended to be a non-existent category, really, when it comes to the general election, because they really tend to sort out ideologically, and so Republican independents go with Republicans, and Democratic independents go with Democrats, and Romney won independents, remember, by 5 points and still lost the general election by four, because the Republican Party is just naturally smaller than the Democratic Party. So if Hillary can gin up enough turnout, she wins going away no matter what happens. And the real possibility was that she would have some difficulty and she would be someone who could be hammered. And now I'm not sure that we can be so certain that the hammering of her will not have terrible negative consequences. It's one thing to attack her for mishandling of classified information, for her conduct with the Clinton Foundation and her dealings, conflicts of interest, her husband's conflicts of interests. Trump is a uniquely ill-prepared and bad person to deliver that message, and he is likely to go into the fever swamps as he did with this insane attack on Ted Cruz out of the National Enquirer, claiming that Ted Cruz's father had somehow been associated with the Kennedy assassination. He'll go back and start talking about things nobody remembers from the Clinton administration involving the mysterious deaths of friends of Hillary's in a park in Virginia, and whether somebody was murdered and the body was carried and all of that, which will thrill some of the more extreme lunatic elements of the Republican right and will appall almost everybody else.
And he'll also add to that whatever National Enquirer story is running that week about Hillary.
Right. So, you know, people think that this is going to be wonderful because he'll hit her the way no one's hit her before. She's been plenty badly hit before. It's an absurd charge to claim that Hillary Clinton has not received a tough press. She received a very tough press last year. Most of what we know about, you know, the hearings and the emails and the Clinton Foundation come from reports in the mainstream press, as well as some from Peter Schweitzer, the author of Clinton Cash. But, I mean, a lot of other things came out because people, the Clintons, despite the fact that there's a lot of talk about how the media are going to, you know, circle the wagons and everything, the Clintons are not that popular. And her failures will get an airing, and the issue is whether he will make the coverage of her failures seem ridiculous because he's going to throw nonsense and crap at the wall to see what sticks.
And in fact, slamming her and really going low will first help her turnout. I mean, that feeds into her narrative and
yeah, you know. Right. So there's that. So this is all great all around. He may not win a lot of Republicans. He may... So his turnout will be depressed. She is a uniquely weak candidate, but she is running in some sense from a historically powerful position. Right now, it appears that Barack Obama's approval rating is hovering around 50%. It is axiomatic in the world of presidential politics that if the president of the party that you're running from, either for your own reelection or for your successor, is at 50% or above, that your successor will win, and if he's below it, he'll lose. And that makes total sense because it's fundamentally how people feel about continuity versus change. And while enormous numbers of people say they think the country is on the wrong track, that doesn't mean that they think the country's on the wrong track because Barack Obama is responsible for it being on the wrong track. A lot of them now believe that it's on the wrong track because of Congress or Republicans in Congress, and so therefore changing presidents doesn't answer their objections. So you know, a lot of this projection about Trump's possible strength has to, I think, be viewed as a weakness, not a strength. And again, that he is in the average of averages, he is 7 to 8 points down in May, and that's an incredibly weak position to start from. And he is who he is, and you know, he grew. The, one of the great stories of this election is that Ted Cruz wins Wisconsin, and then Trump actually accelerates his popularity within the Republican Party as opposed to the other way around, which is not how it was supposed to work. How Trump accelerates his popularity with the American people, absent an exogenous event one desperately hopes doesn't come to pass, a terrorist attack, right. You know, something happens at the Rio Games, I don't know what, that she is, or that Hillary responds to badly, or her indictment or something like that. Absent any of that, he has a very, very, very tough road ahead, as he should, as he deserves to. Maybe the country doesn't deserve it, but he certainly deserves it. But we were talking before about what the Trump triumph says about the condition of American conservatism, and you had some thoughts about this last night.
Yes. There's an understanding that Ted Cruz had repeatedly targeted Trump as not a conservative. That was a big line of argument for Cruz, and overwhelmingly it was met with but the wall or whatever else. It didn't find any purchase. And my thought was that the reason for this is that the idea of conservatism has, I would say, in the past 16 years or so, since the election of George W. Bush, zigged and zagged in different directions, meant different things at different times, and has sort of run out of elasticity so that Trump could walk in and sort of fit, make it whatever he...
Or has excessive elasticity.
Right.
Has now come to mean whatever anybody who says he is conservative wishes it to mean. So it can mean you can be a conservative and be so horrified at the behavior of Planned Parenthood that the thought of voting for somebody who gave money to Planned Parenthood like Donald Trump seems an impossibility, right? So there's, and speaks well of Planned Parenthood. So that's that conservative. And on the other hand, you could be a conservative who thinks that all Muslims should be banned from the United States. And so Trump seems like he's your God in human form. Or you could be a conservative who believes in extreme restraint on spending on the safety net because Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are going to bankrupt the country in 15 years. Or in which case Trump is anathematic to you because he doesn't want to do anything about that. Or you could be the kind of conservative who says, I'm an American nationalist and therefore I want a trade war with China, whereas most conservatives, as understood over the last 30 or 40 years, have been, you know, adamant free traders. So Trump slips in, and in this sort of...
At a time when there's no good working definition of conservative.
Well, the interesting question is whether there was ever a good working definition of conservatism. And as you said, beginning with George W. Bush, George W. Bush began his successful run for the presidency attempting to distance himself from what appeared to be orthodox conservatism of the time, that is Gingrich conservatism. He defined himself as a compassionate conservative. He said, I will not balance the budget on the backs of the poor. He said he was running the person he was thinking he wanted to help was a single mother waitress with two kids, earning $23,000, $24,000 a year, and his tax policy went out of putting money in her pocket rather than taking it out. And of course, and he was going to do No Child Left Behind, this education reform. All of these things, No Child Left Behind has now become a conservative piece of conservative anathema. You mention it and people like throw things at your head. And it's monstrous and evil because it federalized education in some fashion. and compassionate conservatism is terrible because, and it was thought at the time that Bush had done a real act of violence against principled conservative efforts on social policy, which were designed not to hurt the poor but to help the poor by freeing them from the dependency cycle that they had gotten into with government.
And then, and compassionate conservatism as the dominant understanding of conservatism lasted about up until 9/11, which changed a great many things, including the role of conservatives in America. And conservatism then sort of became redefined as defending a forward-leaning U.S. defense policy in response to a great attack. And that was where the intellectual effort went. That was where the argumentation was. That was where the policies were. And it became about conservatism became sort of synonymous with tough national security.
Right. And then there was a great effort to defend and advance on this, both in the elections of 2002 and in Bush's own reelection in 2004, which were fundamentally run as in the first case as a referendum on the domestic efforts on counterterrorism that culminated in the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, and then in 2004 as a referendum on the war in Iraq, which was then marginally more popular than it was unpopular, but which had already started to show the signs of not being the mission accomplished that the banner had said in May of 2003. And so the Bush's victory in 2004 with the first absolute majority that a conservative had won or a Republican had won in an election since 1988 seemed to herald the possible, new age of this kind of conservative dominance. But even as that was happening, great fissures were opening up on the right. People who thought that he'd spent too much, people who were angry about all kinds of things that Bush had done that were violations of conservative principle, domestic price supports for steel, which was basically done to help Tom Ridge in Pennsylvania, though they didn't say that was what they were doing, and the passage of Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefit, which took 3 hours of arm twisting on the floor of the House to pass, and has been, by the way, a wildly popular program, perhaps the most popular social program of the last 50 years, with everybody, including it. It has, in fact, curtailed medical spending and costs, unlike Obamacare, but was extremely unpopular. And then Bush started talking about reforming Social Security, and then he started talking about reforming the immigration system. And with the turnaround in Iraq, the descent into civil war at the end of 2005, and the Hurricane Katrina making it appear as though the federal government was incompetent, and the turn on Bush generally in early 2006, Republicans and conservatives themselves began starting to go after his jugular. He lost his mojo.
Yeah, and even by the time he enacted the surge, and which worked to turn the tide in Iraq, it was sort of too late politically to get credit.
Right. Although the surge was the last moment at which the right stood together en masse, mm-hmm. because Democrats en masse were opposed to it, but the conservative, but it went through in the lame duck Congress, and it was the only plan available. In 2007, Democrats were having hearings expressing extreme skepticism about it, and Hillary said it's failed, told Petraeus he had failed.
Right.
And then, of course, it began to work. But so what? So everything went south, and then in 2008 came the financial meltdown.
Right. And then, so by then, there were recriminations about the war. There was about war spending, that this was in part due to, focus on defense and spending too much on defense and Bush had generally been more of a big government conservative than he had intended to be and than he said he would be.
Well, and then of course also, in fact, Republicans rejected the first effort to deal with the financial meltdown in the form of the first bill to impose TARP. Which was rejected by the House and then had to be reformed and passed a second time, and all kinds of people were opposed to it and saying this is not what we meant at all. Mark Stein, various other people talked about what a horrible seizure of government power it was. We were, you know, all these banks should be allowed to fail. All of this should happen. You know, this is a government intrusion into the free workings of the marketplace. And the Bush answer was basically, I can't stand here and watch as the world's economy melts down. We don't really have a choice. And if you have another idea, tell me what it is. And no one had one. And so Bush ended his term having passed TARP, which arguably did save the world financial system and made him even more unpopular with his own party. And so there the Republicans were, Obama winning a landslide, having a gigantic majority in the Senate, 59 seats, which became 60 after a long recount in Minnesota that finally installed Al Franken as a senator, had a veto-proof majority in the House, and then he went to town, right? And he passed auto nationalization, he passed the trillion-dollar stimulus, the largest government program in history, and then, of course, Obamacare, which came in March of 2010. And all of that, all of that behavior then reconstituted conservatism in a new, in a kind of new form.
Right? Yes, and that was about sort of saying stop, and hold back, and this was the rise of the Tea Party conservatives.
Right, which was a grassroots movement. It really did start largely as a result of an offhand comment by a financial commentator on CNBC. These meetings started. This movement started. It was kind of remarkable to behold. There was a whole lot of talk about how it was some kind of by Democrats and liberals about how this was a new form of fascism that was arising. There would be rallies. Everybody would clean up the site of the rally after it was over and leave it more pristine than they had come. And this movement, which really was to say, you know, we do not believe the government should, you know, that we think Obama left unchecked is going to turn the United States into a European country. That movement was wildly successful in that it revolution won a gigantic victory in the House in 2010, and were it not for a couple of really bad Senate candidates, would have probably won the Senate for Republicans as well. And then suddenly this movement, this negative stop movement, had to do something about governing. And that's when things started to go haywire, in my estimation. Because these conservatives, what they wanted was to elect people to go to Washington and do nothing. And the people who were already there were like, well, you can't do nothing. You have to do something. That's what it means to be in Congress. And they were like, we don't want to vote for anything. We only want to vote against things. So we want to repeal Obamacare. So they would say, okay, well, we want to repeal Obamacare too, but, you know, the president's staying there and he'll veto it, and we can't. And what's more, the Senate, we won't win in the Senate because the Senate's in Democratic hands, and we can't repeal Obamacare. And so it's like, well, then we should shut the government. We have to make Obama spend less. So Obama said he didn't want to spend less. So then they said, okay, we'll shut the government down. So then they shut the government down, and then Obama and John Boehner struck this deal that ended up shrinking the size of government largely by doing it on the back of the U.S. military, which Obama cleverly thought he really had Republicans in a corner because he would have them agreeing to this automatic sequestration cut that they could never accept because it would do such damage to the military that he, of course, was the commander-in-chief of and therefore shouldn't have thrown the military to the wolves in this way. But, of course, he's the commander-in-chief and he hates the military, so he doesn't care. Republicans are like, fine, okay. Most of them, half of them hadn't been in Congress during the War on Terror. They had come for another reason, and they were fine with the military being a lot smaller. So 2011 ends with a government shutdown and a sequester, and then we have this election that Mitt Romney loses, and then arises the next lunatic theory, which is that Romney lost because conservatives stayed home because he wasn't conservative enough.
Right. That's right. And then also, let's not forget that at the same time, the left now is making their big social push and you know, changing the social landscape of the country. The gay marriage took off. What was the?
It was gay marriage. Obamacare was was upheld by the Supreme Court. I mean, the Supreme Court ended up becoming what conservatives had always dreaded that it would be, which is a sort of rubber stamp for radical liberal change. And so, in June 2012, Obamacare was affirmed that it was not unconstitutional. And then in 2014, the Supreme Court validated, essentially mandated gay marriage.
Right, 2014.
Right. Yeah. And so, so all of that was going on.
Yeah, and that ignited a new sort of, you know, strain of fighting and now the war on trans laws and
right.
you know.
But I mean, some of this, I think what we're talking about here is that, again, there were different strains of conservatism that responded to different things. So there was a whole issue with religious liberty that Obamacare was forcing religious institutions right. to do things that were literally transgressive of their of the teachings of their faiths. That and now that after that that the Department of Justice was promulgating regulations that were forcing institutions to do things that were and individuals to do things that were violations of their deepest held beliefs, and that there was no protection of religious liberty, and that was deeply important to one strain of conservatism. And to another strain of conservatism, they didn't care about that, and all what they cared about was creeping socialism or you know, that ISIS was on the march, or I mean, I don't even know what. There were 17 different things, and what happened was whatever the binding glue was of conservatism, by 2015 it was gone.
Right. There's this now. There's this constellation of issues, and so Trump walks in, and it was, you say he's not a conservative. What does that begin to mean? You know, if he's in favor of carpet bombing ISIS, well, that sounds plenty conservative to a bunch of people. If he's in favor of building a wall, that sounds plenty conservative to a bunch of other people, some of the same people. If he's okay with transgenders, well, that's none of our business to some other other conservatives,
right?
You know, so it there was he could make it conservative enough,
or it was conservative enough for enough people. Now remember, we are again talking about somebody who has now won the nomination of the party while getting 40% of the aggregate vote. Mitt Romney got 54% of the aggregate vote by this point. So he is still the least popular person to win the Republican nomination. It's just that nobody else was remotely as popular as he, all of which is a sign of this failure of American conservatism, which is an alliance of a lot, which was a sort of loose agglomeration of a lot of different people with a lot of different concerns, and those concerns could be held together, glued together by policy successes. But when there are no policy successes, and there's only like a litany of failure during the Bush years, and then a litany, an inability to stop the worst, or what appears, what feels like the worst of it, in the Obama years, then the glue cracks, and there is no commonality, and so saying that Trump is not a conservative means nothing, because there is no meaning to conservatism as it is generally understood in the United States, which is to say it's not generally understood in the United States. I mean, none of this makes sense anyway. That is to say, there was a time when I was coming up as a young man 35 years ago, to be a fiscal conservative meant that you were a supporter of the balanced budget. And Reagan did not support the balanced budget. I mean, he made noises, but Reagan supported budget-busting tax cuts to create economic growth. That was a violation of conservative economic orthodoxy that rewrote the rules of conservatism, such as they were, because it's not really conservatism. These are all issues of practical philosophy at how best to run the country, and they're either successful or not successful. Reagan's tax cuts were wildly successful. If they hadn't done their bit, then the Republican Party would certainly have reverted, as Bush Sr. sort of did, because that was to his own orthodoxy, which was budget cutting. And that was the 1990 budget deal in which Bush Sr., you know, sought and achieved real substantive budget cuts in exchange for a tax increase. By doing that, he violated the new conservative orthodoxy, which had only been orthodoxy for 10 years.
All right.
So, you know, the whole point is that in the United States, we're talking about things that are right of center and left of center, and giving them a consistent ideological coloration only works when somebody wins and stitches a coalition together that manages to stay together somewhat comfortably and not so uneasily.
Right. And so now, but if we're no longer, if the most pertinent sort of continuum at the moment is no longer sort of left-right, what is it that we're
No, I think it probably is left-right. In other words, what we have here is an election in which one of the great failings of what happened in the Republican primary is that it took Marco Rubio, 6 months to get to the point of saying, Donald Trump is a con man. He's only in this for himself. He's not going to help you. He's not going to help the country. He's not going to help America. And he doesn't have any consistent principles by which he is going to govern. And therefore, he is not, I'm not saying he's a conservative or not a conservative. I'm saying he's beyond it. He doesn't care about anything. And I think that had some purchase, but it came too late. And Cruz went with the he's not a true conservative, I'm a true conservative. And the problem was that, so the number of people who are very conservative in the Republican Party is 20-25%. So that's what he got. So mazel tov. You can't just get your base and then imagine that you win. The whole point about Trump was that he was the one person in this race. There were 17 people running this race. He was the one person in this race who didn't say, I'm going to win this group, and then I'm going to add on that group, and I'm going to win this group here. He just ran as he ran. He invented the issue set he ran on. It, protectionism and trade, building a wall, sort of aggressive but isolationist foreign policy at the same time. And he didn't look at polls. He didn't look at Henry Olson's book on the four vectors of the Republican Party, and he didn't look at the party decides. He just ran, And all these guys out-clevered themselves. They outsmarted themselves. They had all these strategies. They were going to do this here and that there. We did. They would win this, and then they would add on that, and they would add on. They would accrete a little bit else. And there's no way to win a national, make a national movement like that. You make a national movement by expanding on a vision of the United States in which all your so Trump's general vision is, I'm going to make America great again. And nobody else had anything like that. I mean, Bush had no reason to run. Rubio was running, on an optimistic vision of the future, which is sort of nice, but it didn't actually tell you anything about anything. And Cruz was running as the hardline conservative, and Christie was running as the Trump, without being Trump, the tough guy. And Kasich was the nice guy. And Christie's not that tough, and Kasich's not actually nice, and Rubio is probably optimistic, and Bush was nothing because Bush is nothing. And so Trump, you can't win against something with nothing, and Trump is something, so he won.
Yes, he's we can say he's something.
Now, so the question then is, and yet here we're sitting here, and as we end, we should probably note that Bernie Sanders won another state.
That's right.
Hillary Clinton's won, she's won, she's won, she's won, she's won, and there's Bernie Sanders winning state after state after state.
Now, I met a Sanders supporter about a week ago. I was talking to him, and we got around to politics, and he said he supports Sanders, but if it's Hillary, he goes for Trump.
Right. There is almost no evidence that those people really exist.
That's why I'm bringing up that I actually met one, yes.
I mean, maybe he'll go for Trump, and maybe in the end he won't go for Trump, because my sense is that, that guy doesn't want Muslims, doesn't want Mexicans thrown in camps and Muslims denied entry to the United States and that sort of thing. So, that's all she has to remind people of on her side is where he is and where he comes from and what he says. And it seems to me that she'll solidify her party's vote pretty easily with him as the counterweight.
Yes, I would think so, yes. But it was like spotting the great giant squid. I
You found the Sanders voter who would vote for Trump.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I congratulate you.
Thank you.
Was this person over 30 or under 30?
Yeah, remarkably, he was older. Yeah.
Oh, over 30. Yeah. Okay, so you really found the great.
Yeah, I really. Yes.
Okay, so yes. It's really
no great. No photographic evidence.
The Loch Ness
but I did.
Monster.
Yeah,
I think,
that's right.
Come again to the end of another thrillingly optimistic and forward-looking commentary magazine podcast. There's nothing I can do. People keep complaining that we're too depressing, and I'm trying to be up. I think we're funny and lively, and we're trying to tell you things as we see them. But it's not our fault that reality is horrible. There's nothing that we can do about it. And if we could, I would. I promise you, I would do something about it. My kids are really cute, and I really enjoy them. And if you could play with them, you would enjoy them too. And they're good. And other things in the world are good. And you know, you'll probably enjoy the new Captain America movie, I guess. And I'm watching Rome, which was on HBO 10 years ago, and for some reason I'm watching it now on Amazon Prime, and it's really good. So that makes me happy, and maybe you would like it. Otherwise, I got nothing good to say.
We should have a sort of happy time segment.
Yes, happy times. Close, yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Read P.G. Woodhouse. He's really funny. And of course, we're coming to you fly from the offices of Commentary Magazine. Commentary, the 71-year-old monthly. Most distinguished monthly on the right, with the mandate of defending America, the West, and its institutions, and its principles and purposes, arguing from the highest level of intelligence and incident, and serving as a bulwark against anti-Semitism and this and support of the State of Israel. Please join us at CommentaryMagazine.com. You get 8 free reads a month. If you want more, you subscribe for $19.99 a year. Gets you total digital access to the magazine. And if you go for $29.99 a year, you get our beautiful monthly magazine in your hand as opposed to just on your computer, which is really the best way to read it. That's why we're here. We're conservatives. We believe in the printed word, the codex, the physical product, as opposed to merely the intellectual property. And so as a conservative, you should certainly subscribe to the magazine and have it in your hand, because that which is enduring, that which is real and substantive and enduring, that is what matters. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.